Welcome to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Bill Chaves serves as the Director of Athletics at the University of North Dakota, a job he's held since March of 2018. A two-time recipient of the National Athletic Director of the Year honors, Chaves came to Grand Forks after having spent the previous decade as Director of Athletics at Eastern Washington University. Bill, welcome to Main Street.
Craig, thanks for having me today. Really excited about being here.
Before we start to talk about all things UND athletics, Bill, I need to ask you if you are the one I need to blame for that red turf at Eastern Washington. Is that on you?
Guilty as charged. That was a quick trial.
Nicknamed the Inferno, and I think we are lucky that UND's colors have green in them, Bill. Otherwise, we might be in for something interesting at the Alara Center, too.
It's safe to say, as an athletic director, I go with school colors for our football field.
Bill, you just returned back from the NCAA convention. One of the interesting remarks that I heard departing President Mark Emmert talk about, and it was his last meeting, that there are a few things more consequential in our country than college sports. And he remarked that there are 11,000 college sports teams in our country. What did you take away from the meeting?
Yeah, really good comments by Dr. Emmert, and his time as president is coming to an end here after a decade. And I think he was just trying to give a holistic thought process that although he was there for a decade, it pales in comparison to how long intercollegiate athletics has been a part of the fabric of the United States. And, it goes back well over 150 years. And so with Governor Baker coming on board starting on March 1st, you know, we find ourselves really at a crossroads, like an inflection point. And I think there's just as many things evolve in life, college athletics is doing the same, especially at the Division I level.
Found it interesting that this all started with a rowing match in New Hampshire, of all places.
Lake Winnipesaukee, no question. And, I think that's what makes us unique. If you look around the world, especially if you look to Europe, and obviously they love their soccer or what they would call football, you know, they have clubs. And not that we don't have clubs here in the United States. I think the affection and the affiliation with your alma mater and connecting, right, on a Saturday afternoon when it's 1 o'clock and you're kicking off, and at this point in time, you're all fighting hawks, or you're all, you know, you could be all bison, or you could be all jackrabbits. But at the end of the day, you're all rowing in the same direction.
You had groundbreaking this past August at Memorial Village on campus. It will prove to be, I think, a focal point for UND athletics. Tell me about it. How's that project coming along?
Really excited about it, Craig. You know, under the leadership of Dr. Andy Armacost and our leadership team here, if you go around our entire campus, you're seeing a little bit of a renaissance of, you know, looking at particular buildings, actually reducing square footage on campus, almost trying to look ahead and just say, what will higher ed look like in the next 10, 15, 50, 100 years? And we're preparing for that. And athletics, we're no different. I currently sit in Hislop Sports Center, and Hislop has been famed for Grand Forks, for Red River Valley for 70 years. Like all good houses or structures, sometimes their time has come. So we're able to move across the street, and we're looking forward to moving into some new digs, if you will. It's kind of interesting. We're doing it all kinds of different ways. We've got a public-private partnership right now that is putting together Memorial Village, where we'll occupy the first and parts of the second floor, and then there'll be housing on top. And then across the way, where we have our Pollard Athletic Center, we're working on a addition there, and that's 100% philanthropically raised. So we're trying to do it different ways, but looking ahead and how can we put our athletic programs in the best possible position.
You play football at the Alara Center, and I had a chance to experience my first game there in October. And Bill, I'll say this. I was emotionally exhausted watching that game. I think the fan experience there is on a different level than anything that I have experienced. And I'm guessing that's by design. The music, the attention to detail of the game experience is just so different than it used to be 10 years ago.
Well, thank you for saying that. I'm going to you know, mention my staff at this point in time, who does a tremendous job trying to, you know, figure out how to make it memorable. The game, for sure. You want the 3 hours to be awesome while the game is going on. But we're talking pregame, whether it be the tailgating and, you know, what's happening between quarters, what's happening at halftime, what's happening postgame. So those are things that are really important to us. Obviously, you want to win the game. That even makes it better. But at the end, you know, we want to make sure it's an experience, as you mentioned. And our friends in the city who own the Alera Center, and our friends, our partners, our teammates that run the Alera Center have been outstanding. And it really is, yeah, it's a Grand Forks effort. It's a community effort. And, you know, I feel as if all of our programs, you know, are a community good. And we have to make sure that we make it as best as we can while we have the opportunity, while we sit in the chairs that we do.
You mentioned winning just a moment ago. And of course, every team wants to win every game. That's not always possible, and there are ups and downs. Bill, how do you judge success with your athletic program? Is it all about wins?
You know, it certainly, absolutely, that plays a criteria. Now, you could ask a number of athletic directors around the country and say, what business are you in? And that it might be interesting, the responses you get. You know, I do believe I'm still in the educational business. And I think if we are doing right by our student athletes and our coaches, their teachers at heart, if we're making sure that they're doing the right things in the classroom, in the community, on campus, obviously they want to win games. And if we're doing all four of those, then we're hitting on, you know, high cylinders. I would say in the classroom right now, in fact, we just came off our best grade point average in the Division I era since 2008. We had a 3.54 amongst all of our 17 programs and our 325 student athletes. Last year, we were top school in all of Division I in community service. And so those are the things we can control. The wins and losses, of course, make a difference. And those are some of the things we kind of can't control. But, you know, obviously winning at the Division I level is something we do discuss, and it factors in.
This is a tough year for the UND hockey team, relatively speaking. Things ebb and flow on campus. What are your current thoughts about the state of hockey, which I would argue is your premier program?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. You're right. I mean, from a wins-loss standpoint, we're sitting at about 500, and that's somewhat uncommon for us at this stage. I think we've gone through a couple of interesting weekends here. We've played a really difficult schedule, played the top four out of five teams in the country. And so I think we certainly know what our ups are, but we also, our variance has been great this year. And I know our coaches are still working it through at this stage of the game and trying to, everything's still in front of us, but our margin for error is thinner than normal at this stage of the game. And, you know, we have probably one of the better college hockey writers in the country in Grand Forks. And he put together some advanced analytics and indicated, just based on expected goals, weirdly, we're underperforming. And if you looked at all of the teams in the conference, everyone's performing exactly pretty much where they should be, except we should be almost 10 games better. And a team like St. Cloud is actually overperforming, and they probably should be kind of where we are, and they are exactly, you know, where they are at 16-6. So it's kind of interesting. But you know what? Our guys are grinding. It's only January. We've still got a lot in front of us. And, you know, the good news about the NCHC is everyone makes the tournament. So there are pathways to where we want to get to.
And you'll host a regional.
We will in Fargo. So we've been fortunate that the NCAA has provided that opportunity to our state, to our region for well over, you know, the last half dozen to a dozen years. And our staff does a tremendous job with Shields Arena. And we're excited about that for sure. Obviously, the Fighting Hawks being there is something that, you know, obviously icing on the cake and things that are still in front of us. But we do have work to do.
There are some issues that are front and center in college sports, not the least of which is whether college athletes are considered employees or will be considered in the future, perhaps someday, as an employee. In fact, there is a federal appeals court that NCAA will ask next month to block a lawsuit that seeks to have athletes treated as employees. What have you thought about that lawsuit? whether athletes should be considered as employees and what that would mean to your program?
Yeah, really good question, Craig. And I think that's the House lawsuit. And so, I coming back from the NCAA convention, listening to Governor Baker as he took the baton from Dr. Emmert, I think it was pretty clear. They, being the board of directors, the presidents of the NCAA, made it pretty clear that if he can get an audience with Congress in some way, somehow, there's three areas in which he's hopeful that he can get their attention. One is actually the very first one is to affirm that student athletes are not employees because of the unique relationship that students do have with their universities. It's not an employment-based model. So it'd be very interesting to see where that goes. But I think there's at least a hopeful conversation with folks in Congress. And I'll just mention the other two is one. Second one would be provide a safe harbor of just a narrow safe harbor of antitrust exemption when it comes to association-wide rules. What's happened is there's been so much litigation in regards to any rule that's put in place by the association that I think that there's a hope that there can at least be a narrow window where as long as it benefits the members, that it would be exempt from litigation. And then the third one is if federal legal framework occurs at the Congress level, at the congressional level, that it will supersede any state law pertaining to collegiate sports. And that really speaks to name, image, and likeness, because right now we've got a patchwork of laws across all 50 states. Some states don't have laws like North Dakota.
All of these issues, it's interesting to me that the NCAA is hoping for congressional intervention, if you will, that maybe help define, I guess, the playing field. NIL is one of those issues that is front and center in the news. Is this something you have visited with the North Dakota delegation about? Is this something that's on their minds too?
You know, we did early on, Craig, but what's happened is when the NCAA decided back in July of June 28th of 21, where we thought there was going to be an association-wide rule in regards to NIL on July 1, what they came back with was you can stick to your state law at this point, or if you don't have one, you can provide an NIL rule yourself institutionally. And because we don't have one, we chose obviously the latter. And it's worked out okay for us. I'll be honest with you. I am not sure at this moment, as at this recording, that we necessarily need an NIL law in this state. I think we need to be cognizant of what's happening nationally and hope that there could be consistency from state to state. I think early on, what ended up happening was states got into it a bit and put some guardrails on it for sure. But then as it's evolved, they've loosened the guardrails because at the end of the day, I think they saw the potential recruiting advantages by having a less intrusive law. And so, and I will say that's probably more, I'll call it, at the Autonomy 5, Power
sure.
5 level.
Sure.
I'd say that's kind of where we're at right now. That's why there's an ask out there, because when you do go to Congress, you do think about it. Congressmen and women, they all have alma maters, right? They've all been to school somewhere. So this affects everybody that's up on the Hill.
You participate in the Summit League. Is that a great league for the University of North Dakota?
It's been tremendous. I'll tell you, we've been in the Summit League now for 4 years, and it's been outstanding. And it's been a little bit of a journey for us. We went from Division II to Division I. We had a transition period. We were in the Great West Conference. We were in the Big Sky Conference. And now we're back regionally where we should be in all three conferences, whether it's the Summit League for the majority of our sports, the National Collegiate Hockey Conference for hockey, or the Missouri Valley Football Conference for football. We're regionally where we need to be. We're playing the right schools from a conference standpoint, and that makes a huge difference when it comes to recruiting.
We're visiting with Bill Chaves. He's the University of North Dakota Director of Athletics. Director Chaves, also an important part of your job is revenue. And if I were to ask you to look at your budget and tell me where it needs revenue enhancement, where would you tell me that would be? And where is there room, I guess, to have more revenue for UND athletics?
Yeah, so I think two things. One, I think you're always making sure that you are looking at what you're expending currently and making sure that it's wise expenditures. And so that if you have to move any funding from, say, X pot to Y pot, you do that. But we are funded, you know, by a number of funding mechanisms or streams. Certainly, the institution, along with our student body, account for a percentage of our budget. We over greater than 50% of our budget does come from external revenue sources, though. That could be ticket sales. That could be NCAA distributions based on various tournaments, licensing dollars, guarantee dollars. If we go and play a 1A FBS football game like we did at Nebraska this year, that guarantee was $575,000. The most logical thing is, you know, sell out the Alaris Center every Saturday. You know, we do okay right now, but I think we could be selling it out. If we do that, that'll help our coffers. Obviously, the Ralph has been tremendous, and our partners with the Ralph Engelstad Arena, Jody Hodson, the general manager. It's tremendous what comes in on a Friday and a Saturday night when we have home hockey series. But our basketball teams, you know, at the Betty Engelstad Sioux Center, where our volleyball and basketball teams play, certainly there's an upside still that we could attain, and that would be more into the ticket revenue area.
And we've noticed that nationally, that basketball in particular has, in many places, I guess, challenges for attendance. Why is that today, when it is a marketable product, have a competitive team, it's a cold North Dakota night, what else are you going to do? What is the reason that people don't flock maybe to sports, maybe like they used to?
It's a really good question, Craig. You know, I would say the advent of technology, certainly, where you can watch many, many games throughout the country. You know, all of our game, not even the country, worldwide. I mean, if you want to watch our teams play, and you know, you're taking a trip to Spain, as long as you can deal with the hour changeover, so to speak, you can watch us. And so I just think there's opportunities right now that maybe weren't there back, let's just say 15, 20 years ago. So that means we have to be more creative. We have to, you know, we have to make it an experience, because there's still something, you know, communal about going to a game and being there live. And that's something that we continue to work on. And we have to continue to listen to our fan base too. If there's something that we're missing and we need to be doing, we have to make sure we're engaged with them so that we're getting that feedback.
I'm curious, if you look at the analytics, and I'm sure you see analytics on who watches your streams of your games, et cetera, and broadcast too. When you add all those numbers up, is it still fewer than used to come to games 10, 15 years ago? Or is it maybe about the same when you toss it all together in the salad bowl?
Yeah, it's about the same. Because you know what? We're getting opportunities for folks that don't have to be in Grand Forks to come watch us. Okay. So, you know, we found that too with our hockey team has had some destination games. And so it just happened to be a back-to-back year because of COVID. So we went to Las Vegas this year and Nashville last year. And we looked at the zip codes of who came. And a lot of folks were coming from all over, literally the world, but certainly the country, to go to that one game because it was so exciting for them to do that. And so they may not have seen a game in Grand Forks in a while, but they wanted to go watch us play, whether it be in Vegas or Nashville, and we've done New York in the past as well.
Bill, I want to talk to you about media relations from the context of back in the day. You likely would have had certainly a Grand Forks newspaper guy at everything that you did, or two or three, or newspaper woman, covering practices, covering games, and perhaps from other smaller town newspapers around as well. And those things just don't exist anymore. So are you able to get the word out using media about what happens to your teams and their games? Is it all just now social media and websites? Or are you concerned that there aren't journalists, if you will, sports guys who come to the games in person anymore?
Well, you know, funny, I mentioned Brad Schlossman earlier in this interview, and, you know, we're really fortunate here in Grand Forks, where the Grand Forks Herald does a wonderful job, led by Wayne Nelson and Tom Miller as well, and Brad, who cover us. And that's not everywhere around the country, for sure. So we're fortunate that I would say we have the traditional coverage, but then we also know that we have to almost cover ourselves, too. And so and we talk about this quite a bit, and we do it from a digital standpoint. You know, still our website, I would still say, is the anchor or the hub that you go to, but we also have a lot of social platforms that, you know, these days is a lot of snackable type of content there. And
snackable.
So I think that's where we are in life.
Yeah.
That's just where we are. And, you know, it can't be too long. And so, you know, you got to let folks munch on it. And so that's kind of where we are. And, you know, we do have a great radio partner in iHeart here in town, and also Midco, who does many of our games via television. And so our cable partner. And so I think we're really fortunate here at UND, but I do think this, and probably it maybe gets to your question, we as a department also have to see ourselves as a media group as well, getting the word out. And maybe before it was always kind of servicing the media, we actually have to look at ourselves as what are we doing today? What's the content that we're producing?
We talked about name, image, and likeness earlier, and that's where athletes can profit personally from their name or their image or their likeness on behalf of what they do for the University of North Dakota. There is also this thing called the transfer portal. How has that impacted what happens at UND? Is it the case where you look at the transfer portal now when you recruit because you have to, because everyone else does, you prefer not to, you'd rather recruit that high school senior and grow that athlete, if you will? Are there concerns with kids, gosh darn it, I'm not happy because the coach did X or Y and now I'm in the portal and here we go? How's that impacted sports at UND?
Yeah, so maybe I'm one of the few ADs in the country that'll answer it this way. I like the transfer portal. I'm fine with it. All it is a mechanism. That's all it is. We've always had transfer. And so that's never not been something that's occurred over the course of time. I think what's been interesting over the last couple of years, though, there were always five sports that you could not transfer and be eligible. You had to have a year in residency. So football, the two basketballs, hockey, and baseball were always exempted from that year in residency. Well, that opened up. So they're like now all the other sports that you can transfer one time and be eligible right away. So that happens simultaneously with the advent of what we call the transfer portal. And so I think the portal's gotten a kind of an interesting name, but the reality of it is all it is a mechanism that gets students from point A to point B. And, you know, it gets a lot of play for sure, but it's an and for our coaching staff. It's not something that is just exclusive, right? I still think you build your programs with high school students coming in. But I do think if you do need a tuba player, it's nice that you can go get a tuba player in the transfer portal.
Bill, we've got just a few seconds left. I'm going to give you one magic wand moment. And you can do one thing for the University of North Dakota's athletic program. You can build a facility. You can bring back a sport. You can add a sport. You can do one thing. What are you going to do?
You know, I would say this. I would provide all types of support that our student athletes need during these days. And some of it is financial and some of it's not. You know, I think I would love to have, you know, every sport that the NCAA offers a championship in. I'm not sure how realistic that is. So I think I would stay in the box of whatever we can do to support our students. That's what I'd want to do. I think we do a good job of it, Craig. I really do. But there's always, you can always do more. And I think that's something that I see today where, especially with the advent of social media and the open nature of where our students are right now, it's a different world than probably when you and I were in college and growing up. And as much as I can support them, that's what I would wish for.
Bill Chase, he's the Director of Athletics at the University of North Dakota. Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Really appreciate it, Craig.
We'll have more Main Street after the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's House Minority Leader says child care is a very big issue the 2023 legislature will tackle. Fargo Democratic Representative Josh Boucher says leaders of both parties agree there is a need for available and affordable child care.
Child care workers are the workforce that supports our workforce. Without us having quality, affordable child care throughout the state, other parents aren't able to go to work.
Boucher says lawmakers are looking at a three-pronged approach to child care.
First of all, we need to make sure that we continue putting resources to making it more affordable by helping with child care assistance program. That was boosted with the COVID dollars coming out of the pandemic. we need to put some state dollars behind that as well. The second part is making sure that we're providing opportunities for capacity. So how are we making sure we're growing spots throughout the state that are quality, that are in all sectors throughout the state? And then third, and probably even more importantly, is making sure that we're able to pay childcare workers what it's worth to do that job.
Boucher says as employers struggle to find workers, having available daycare will help. The North Dakota House has passed a bill requiring a school district that offers a life science curriculum to include human growth and development, which will include a high-definition ultrasound video that shows the process of fertilization and every stage of development inside the uterus. The vote on House Bill 1265 was 60-34. Williston Republican Representative Scott Dyke is one of the bill's sponsors. He told the House the bill is one, as he put it, a fabulous way to be an example to the nation to enhance the protection of the unborn.
While other states are unashamedly offering financial help to come to their soil to destroy the unborn, to soak their soil with blood that will cry out to the heavens, we, on the other hand, can be a state that promotes protection and financial help for the most vulnerable.
Opponents said curriculum should not be dictated by the legislature, but should come from the state's Department of Public Instruction. They also objected to the bill not going through the House Education Committee. Barring reconsideration, the bill will now be considered by the state Senate. And responding to public opposition of the plan to remove the wild horses from Theodore Roosevelt National Park, Governor Doug Burgum submitted a letter today urging the National Park Service to maintain the herd. In the letter, Burgum urged the NPS to find a way to manage the wild horses in a way that supports genetic diversity.
Removing these horses from the park or reducing the herd size to a level that fails to support genetic diversity and longevity would strike a blow not only to park visitation, but the economic vitality of Medora and nearby communities, including Dickinson, Watford City, Williston, and our entire state.
Governor Burgum offered to meet face-to-face with the NPS to provide the state's help in managing the herd. The public comment period on the NPS management plan closes Tuesday, January 31st. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Touchmark at Harwood Groves Fargo and on West Century in Bismarck. Touchmark offers maintenance-free living so residents have more time to enjoy what they love. Fresh prepared meals, health and fitness club, and a full calendar of events with friends nearby. Learn more at touchmark.com. The Fargo-Moorhead Choral Artists presents a singing Valentine concert and silent auction event on Saturday, February 11th at the Courtyard by Marriott in Moorhead. The event begins at 6 p.m. with a silent auction and dinner, followed by a concert of love songs. Tickets are available online at fmchoralartists.org through February 2nd.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. 3 years ago this week, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Alex Azar, declared COVID-19 a public health emergency. On March 11, 2020, North Dakota's first case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Ward County. We want an update on all things COVID, and here to discuss is Brendan Niesmeyer. He's the field epidemiologist, director of field services for the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services. Brenton, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, and thank you for having us.
And Jenny Galbraith, she's the adult vaccine manager for the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services. Jenny, welcome to Main Street.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It has been 3 years since COVID came into all of our lives, and so much has happened since. And let's start with the current variants that we're hearing information about.
Yes, and I will be happy to take that question. So COVID, like flu, continues to evolve. We will always have new strains of COVID, and we just need to be aware of the symptoms and how to protect ourselves. With every variant, the best way to protect yourself is to be up to date on your vaccine. Vaccines, although you may still get COVID disease, the vaccines will help protect you against severe outcomes such as hospitalization or death. The current variants that are really circulating have an advantage over the older strains, because they may be just a little bit genetically different and may be able to cause disease, whereas you may have had some immunity to previous strains. Right now, our predominant variants in North Dakota are BQ.1 and BQ.1.1, but XBB.1.5 is starting to take off a bit in the state. And these are just kind of what we're seeing worldwide. We aren't seeing as severe disease, but we just need to be aware that they are circulating, and you know, past infection or an infection maybe a year ago may not be enough, and if you haven't been recently boosted or up to date on your vaccines, now is time to go in and become up to date.
Jenny, I want to go right there because for many of us who have tried to follow this, what does being up to date today mean for our COVID vaccine?
Yeah, and I 100% agree. It's been really confusing and it's changed quite a bit and really hard to follow for really anyone, not just the public. As of today, in this exact moment, being up to date means completing a primary series of the COVID vaccine. That's typically the first two doses that you get. That would be with what we call currently the monovalent product or the old original COVID vaccine. So that's your first, typically two doses for most people. And then getting the third bivalent booster dose. So that's the new updated vaccine that contains the bivalent part of the vaccine, which is BA4, BA5, which you just heard Brenton talk about a little bit, and then also the original strain. So really getting those three doses over the course of about 3 months or so, if you're just starting off new, would be most people in the up-to-date category.
If I have been up-to-date, how often do I need a booster? Should I wait until another rendition, if you will, of a COVID vaccine comes out? Should I be going to my provider every 6 months, every 4 months, every year? I'm really confused about that personally. What's your advice for someone like me?
Yeah, so FDA is actually discussing this right now. In fact, there was a meeting yesterday with their independent review committee discussing this very topic. And I think what we can see and kind of form is that we don't know fully yet. There's a couple of things we do know. We know that these bivalent boosters are really restoring protection for most people. And the ones we're really concerned about are 65 and older, people who are immunocompromised. They're restoring protection against hospitalization and severe disease. What that duration of protection looks like now, I think is still kind of up in the air as we move forward. There's definitely discussions with the FDA about whether or not a once a year, like a flu vaccine, would be effective. You know, in some countries, they're using every 6 months for 65 and older, or sometimes 75 and older. I think right now we don't know. What I can say is, if you have received a bivalent booster at this moment, you are as up to date as you can be until there's a decision made by the FDA. There is nothing more you need to do. There are no additional doses you need at this time.
Brenton, what do our stats look like today in North Dakota? It seems to me, anecdotally, that this is somewhat of a mild winter so far relative to COVID-19. Is that true?
You know, we have seen our flu season is on the downward trend. Our RSV season is on the downward trend, and COVID seems to be leveling off or about the same. One of the reasons being we were worried about this tridemic of sorts, you know, an RSV, flu, and COVID all at the same time. But we haven't really seen the large spike in COVID hospitalizations and COVID deaths as we did previously. And that could be partly due to the fact that many of us or most of us are either protected by vaccine, we are protected by natural infection, or we are protected by what we call hybrid immunity, where you've been infected naturally and have had vaccine protection. The combination of all that has really led to what you would say, or what we would say as less severe outcomes, just because we have some protection against disease, and you know, our antibodies are able to fight off some of that, thereby reducing the burden or strain on hospital systems, long-term care facilities, and group homes and things like that.
Jenny, we've heard nationally that for children, adoption, I guess, of a COVID vaccine has been slow and maybe lower than anticipated. Is that true here in North Dakota? And what is the messaging from the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services relative to young children? And I'm talking about age 2 and up, kindergarten and up, and then middle school and high school. What is your message coming from your office?
Yeah, it's definitely true in North Dakota, as well as the entirety of the United States. There are not a lot of kids that have been vaccinated either for their primary dose or then have gone on to receive a bivalent booster. It's really tricky. When these first vaccines first came out, I think people thought they were going to be perfect against protecting symptomatic disease. But then we quickly learned that it's not perfect. And so once these vaccines became available for kiddos, and our messaging has been, you know, keeping people safe out of the hospital from dying, I think a lot of people have the perception that there's no kids being hospitalized or dying from COVID. I really think our message is that, yes, it may happen, and it does happen less likely in children than, say, an adult in their 90s. But it certainly does happen. And using kind of the excuse of my kid will never be hospitalized, they're healthy, really isn't perfect, because we know that there are healthy kids that have been hospitalized and died from COVID. So I would say just talk to a healthcare provider as well. If your kid hasn't had COVID or hasn't ever been diagnosed with COVID, that would certainly drive a decision as well.
Jenny, when you say for a child that has not had COVID or had been diagnosed with COVID, that should be part of the decision. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I think we've kind of learned throughout the course of COVID that there is some level of protection from what Brenton and I would call natural immunity. So you've gotten sick, you've tested positive with COVID. How long that natural protection lasts, I think, is still really up in the air. Typically, to be safe, we would say 3 months. So if your child hasn't had COVID ever, or particularly within 3 months, that would be a perfect time to start looking at vaccination. You know, if your child had COVID 2 weeks ago and you're not up to date, or they're not up to date, you may be able to delay that vaccination a little while and still be kind of in that protected window. It's really all about having that conversation, though, with a healthcare provider that knows your child, knows their chronic health conditions, knows kind of about their life and their health, and making that decision with them.
Is the pharmacist still the place of choice to go to get a COVID vaccine? And are they still covered by all insurances? Are they free? Is there cost now when there didn't used to be? What's the status of actually finding a place to get a vaccination?
Yeah, so vaccine is widely available in North Dakota. Pharmacies are a good option, local public health. And then as we talk about specifically the really little kids, the 6 months to 2 years, pediatric or your primary care provider office would be a really good choice. These vaccines are still being provided free of charge to the United States public by the federal government. So there should be no cost associated with them still. You may find if you go into a private healthcare office, they may charge like an office fee or something like that, especially if you're going in and getting other services. But the cost of the vaccine itself, the actual product, will be free.
Brenton, I want to turn back to you relative to what do the statistics say about the future of COVID-19 in North Dakota? Are there things that we should be cognizant of? Is it still, in your mind, an issue that should be on our plate to think about? Or has it really become just something that's just out there, just like the flu and everything else?
You know, I'd like to think that it's out there and just kind of like everything else. What we don't know and what we are still learning is how often we're going to have peaks and valleys, right? With flu season, we know flu season is generally going to be October to like March or April, you know, somewhere in that time frame. Typically, we saw our peak, you know, in December, early January. We see a peak in February. But what we don't know about COVID is when peaks and valleys or plateaus are going to occur. And that's what we're kind of learning about. You know, things to do to protect yourself is just be aware of current events. Be aware of what's circulating in your community. And then if you are feeling unwell, have symptoms of COVID, consider digging out that home test, staying home, go talk to your primary care provider. There are medications out there, especially if you're immunocompromised, like Paxlovid, which are super effective at preventing severe disease. So if you are 65 and older, have underlying health conditions and concerned about being sick and concerned if you have COVID, make sure to get tested early on, because those medications and those treatments are best or most effective when given early on in the onset of disease versus when you're going to the hospital and you're so short of breath that we need to have you be intubated or put up on a respirator, then at that point, it may be too late to have the maximum effect of those medications.
I want to ask you two questions about what you just talked about. First, the medications, and then about tests. Relative to the medications, our family found it frustrating when my wife got COVID diagnosed, I'd say maybe about a year ago or so, and she didn't feel well. Went to her doctor and said, can you give me the prescription that you just talked about? I want to get better sooner. And the physician looked at her and said, nope, you're not in one of those. You're not old enough. You're not in one of those immunocompromised health positions. Sorry, you just have to kind of wait it out. And I thought, man, that's too bad, because everything I have read is exactly what you said, Brenton, that would have made it easier for her. Yes, she didn't have to go to the hospital, but it was a week of her life, so to speak, that she just did not feel well, and maybe she could have gotten better sooner. That was frustrating for us.
So about a year ago when these medications were first out, you know, it's been about a year. That's when my grandma had COVID, and we had given her some medication. But at that point, the medications were new and, you know, not readily available on the market. So they did really limit them to those who met those certain groups, 65 and older, a couple underlying health conditions. They may have been keeping them back just in case we had a severe spike, like in a long-term care facility or somewhere where people may have been more vulnerable. That's not as much of a case now, as they become more widely available and manufacturers have been able to keep up to demand, if that all makes sense.
Yeah. About tests, we also just understood that we could get four more tests in the mail. So we filled out the little form and last week got our test and they arrived. They were all expired. Then we saw a news note online that really, it may not be expired. Here's a website you can go to check to see if yours has an extended length. That was frustrating. We did that and come to find out ours are still okay, apparently, for a while. But why is that? And what is your advice to people about these tests that they may have had in their shelf for quite a while?
So really, these tests are evolving. And what we, you know, with other tests on the market, we know how long they are good for. Because let's just take a flu test. Flu has been around forever. We know that 5 years, like if we had a flu test, let's just say a flu test at home, we know from, you know, data and just practicality and using of it, that test is good for a 5 year time period. With these home tests, they manufactured them, they produced them. It's all real time. So we are continually extending those expiration dates as the manufacturers are discovering that these expiration dates can be extended. Really, an expired home test, if you're positive on, let's say it was expired and you're positive on an expired home test, you're likely going to be positive. Even on an expired test, even if it's expired, a positive test likely would not happen on something that is expired. It's where you get a negative test or a test that may be faintly positive that it maybe become a little bit more tricky, where you would consider testing yourself again the following day or seeking out another test if it truly is expired. But as of now, these home tests are being continually extended. You did reference the website, so I would encourage everyone to look to that website to see what the status of their home tests are. But they are better than nothing, and if you are taking a home test and just trying to protect yourself, don't need to go to a doctor. If you have an expired one, it's worth a shot still to use versus throwing it out.
What do we know about long COVID? And either one of you perhaps can respond to this. Is it more prevalent here in North Dakota than it is nationally? Is it more prevalent elsewhere where people have symptoms 3 months, 6 months, a year after they've had COVID? What do we know about long COVID?
So long COVID is really, really tricky. And since COVID is very new within the last 3 years, we really don't know much about long COVID. There's really no standard definition. And it's hard because symptoms can vary from person to person and multiple systems may be involved. Some people may have cardiovascular problems. Some people may have brain problems. Some people may have long-term respiratory problems. So we are still learning a lot about long COVID. And it's, you know, through these long COVID clinics, I believe Sanford had one at one point, or they may still have one, or John Hopkins or the Mayo Clinic, where individuals who have long COVID-like symptoms and who have a confirmed diagnosis, where they're getting tested, they're doing blood work, they're getting follow-ups with providers, that we are really learning about what long COVID is and how to properly treat and diagnose it. But as of now, it's really, really hard because of the complexity of it and how new long COVID truly is.
Jenny, do we have any data from people who have gotten vaccines versus people who don't but still get COVID as to whether they may have long-term COVID issues?
Yeah, so the same issues that kind of exist as like counting what long COVID is also kind of applies here. Because we don't have a standard definition of long COVID, we can't look to a person and go, oh, you have a cardiovascular something extending out past 3 months from your COVID diagnosis, so that's long COVID. I think we don't know enough yet to really have anything concrete. I will say, just listening to the FDA and CDC, they're very interested in this and are working on, you know, trials or studies to really try to define what long COVID is and kind of give it some context around vaccination and how often it actually does happen.
Are you both able to get the data that you need from all over the state of North Dakota? Are entities reporting like you would like them to?
Our providers are really good about reporting doses administered. So Johnny came into the clinic, he got a bivalent booster. That's really good and well reported. I think for things like adverse events, long COVID, who even gets COVID after being vaccinated or hospitalized after being vaccinated, it's really tricky, and we rely on really national systems for this. I think there's a maybe perception that North Dakota would be a great place and just like a great spotlight into this, but we have a really small population and a relatively small vaccination rate. Doing any sort of analysis on just North Dakota data could be really tricky.
And Jenny, where can people go to get more information?
You know, I would just point people really towards, you know, our website, hhs.nd.gov, or someplace like the CDC, FDA, really reputable resources that you know are collecting good information.
Brenton Niesmeyer, he's the field epidemiologist and director of field services for the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services. Brenton, thank you so much for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you so much for having us, and thank you for having this very timely discussion. And I hope everyone gets something out of it today.
Good. We sure do, too. And Jenny Galbraith, the adult vaccine manager for the North Dakota Department of Health and Human Services. Thank you so much for joining us, Jenny.
Yeah, of course. And thanks for having us as well.
Dakota Datebook is next.
The Empire Theater Company presents The Lifespan of a Fact, based on the true story about the John DeGatta essay entitled What Happens There. Fingal has a small job to fact-check articles for one of the best magazines in the country. But Fingal has a huge problem. DeGatta made up much of his article. What starts as professional quickly becomes profane. Performances run January 26th through February 5th. Details at EmpireArtCenter.com.
Today's Dakota Datebook is part of an ongoing weekly series produced in partnership with the Department of Public Instruction on Indigenous Peoples themes.
North Dakota Native American Essential Understanding Number 7 is about Native identity. It states, individual and communal identity is defined and supported by shared Native languages, kinship systems, teoshpaye, clan structures, traditional teachings, values, sacred laws, and ceremonies. A continuum of tribal identity, unique to each individual, ranges from assimilated to traditional lifestyle. There is no generic American Indian. In this episode of Dakota Datebook, we'll hear Carol Davis, enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, share how she honors her traditional ways of practicing her spiritual way of life, as well as her Catholic upbringing.
Well, when I started to go to ceremonies, I had been Catholic. My parents had been Catholic. My grandparents were Catholic. And so I don't know what they were before my grandparents, but I know my grandparents and my parents were both Catholics. And so we just naturally, you know, just, I guess that balance, you know, Native always, you know, believe in something. And so we were nurturing our spiritual lives. And but when I started to go to ceremony, I was still going to church, to the Catholic church. And so I thought, am I doing something wrong? Is this, what do I do about this? I was getting really serious because I loved Sundance and I loved Sweat Lodge and and at the same time, I loved going to church on Sunday morning. I'd go to church. So I thought, this is getting serious and I really need to talk to somebody. And so I went and found one of our spiritual leaders and took tobacco and I said, I have a very serious question. And I said, it's going to make a difference in my life. And I said, I want you to guide me. And I said, I do these ceremonies. I go to ceremony. Then I go to church on Sunday and practice the Catholic way. And then I have a name. I've got my name in ceremony. My children have names. My grandchildren have names. I take them to ceremony. I said, am I doing something wrong? And the spiritual leader said, there is no wrong way to pray.
I'm Sharla Stever. If you'd like to learn more about the North Dakota Native American Essential Understandings and to listen to more Indigenous elder interviews, visit www.teachingsofourelders.org.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra continues the season of Between Cultures with American Women, February 4th at the Bell Mihus Auditorium in downtown Bismarck. Featuring music of some of the leading female composers of our time and vocalist Tammy Hensrud. More concert information and tickets available now online at BismarckMandanSymphony.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that's it for today's edition of Main Street. Tomorrow, we'll learn about Veterans Story Preservation Day that's coming up at the Fargo Air Museum. And after a suggestion from a listener, we'll visit with Amanda McMahon. We'll talk about the Prairie Recovery Center in Raleigh, North Dakota. They support vets with PTSD and provide other services as well. That's all tomorrow on Main Street. Thank you so much for joining us, and have a great rest of your day.